This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org. Years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In the market for a cherry of a used car that's easy on the gas budget? Seems some of us are lining up to buy 10-year-old Geo Metros these days. If you can find one, that is. Business Week reports asking prices are as high as $7,000. Not bad considering they sold new for not much more than that. Then again, you could just take the bus. But even that option might soon depend on whether you'll be able to find one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Rizdahl, who's on assignment. Glad you could be with us on this Monday, the second day of June. We Americans aren't the only ones desperate for some relief from rising fuel prices. From truckers and taxi drivers to fishermen, protests continued across Europe today. In France, truckers blockaded refineries and brought traffic to a crawl with slow-moving convoys. In Portugal, fishermen simply left their boats tied up at the docks for a fourth straight day. Here at home, the Wall Street Journal reported today some employers are switching to a four-day work week to reduce the number of trips to and from the office. And even public transportation is seeing a record jump in ridership. But there's a hitch. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
The American Public Transportation Association reported today that the number of people riding buses and trains rose more than 3% in the first 3 months of the year. Light rail saw a 10% jump. Association spokesman Mantel Williams says that's breaking records.
The last time we've seen these type of numbers is probably back like in the 70s when we had oil embargoes, when there were some issues with supply.
Williams says $4 a gallon gasoline appears to be the tipping point, but he says this time there's no sign of relief.
So once we move more beyond $4 per gallon, we think that you're going to see an even bigger increase in ridership.
That sounds like a good thing for the nation's cash-strapped public transportation systems, but transportation engineer Stephen Polzin with the University of South Florida says few cities can handle the increased ridership.
Just a small shift of drivers to public transportation means a huge increase from public transportation's perspective.
Only about 5% of American workers commute by bus or train. Polzin says most of today's transit systems were designed with that in mind, and adding more trains, buses, and rails can take decades.
It's a little bit like the obesely overweight patient wanting to, you know, to purchase something off the programming for 1995 and get thin in 2 weeks. You know, doesn't happen.
Especially when budget shortfalls and rising fuel costs for buses have already caused a fifth of the nation's public transportation systems to cut service. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Banks that make student loans are getting choosy. Even if they're still happy to lend to Ivy Leaguers, they're slamming the door on students from community colleges. Some say it's not fair. Others say that's business. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Since the latest credit crunch, banks have been reevaluating risk. The latest group to be hit by this are students at community colleges and technical schools. John Dean is special counsel at the Consumer Bankers Association.
It was like a chain of dominoes. Financing just simply stopped dead, and the banks were suddenly flooded with additional applications for loans.
Statistically, students at these schools are more likely to default. Harris Miller is president of the school's trade group, the Career College Association. He says without loans, the students will become part of a permanent underclass.
The people who provide the skills in the operating room to support the surgeon, the people who support the IT network.
Now, these loans are backed by the federal government, but banks still don't like them because they're risky, and it's hard for banks to sell the debt. There is another option. Students can get a private loan not backed by the government from lenders like this one, spoofed in a YouTube video.
And don't forget, you don't have to pay us until the day after you graduate.
Wait, a day after?
But Terry Hartle of the American Council on Education says those loans are becoming scarce at even some four-year colleges.
The worry here would be for trade schools and for small private colleges and universities.
You can get a student loan directly from the government, but those loans are limited, enough to pay the tuition at a community college, but not much else. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The U.S. government has long been weaving a safety net for cotton farmers. They get a federal subsidy if world cotton prices get too low. Enter Brazil, which complains the subsidies are unfair. 6 years ago, it took the case to the World Trade Organization, and today the U.S. lost its final appeal. That means Brazil can retaliate with tariffs if the U.S. doesn't change its cotton subsidy program. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
Today's WTO ruling opens the door for Brazil to impose so-called retaliatory trade sanctions. Basically, that means Brazil could punish unrelated U.S. industries until the U.S. amends its cotton subsidy program. Economist Bruce Babcock is with Iowa State University. He says Brazil may have several U.S. firms in its crosshairs.
Probably the most important will be the drug companies. Following that would be some seed companies like Monsanto and DuPont.
Retaliatory tariffs from Brazil could cost the U.S. firms upward of $1 billion a year. The WTO has consistently ruled that U.S. cotton subsidies encourage U.S. cotton overproduction. That depresses world prices. With today's ruling, the U.S. has no avenues left for appeal. The Bush administration says it will continue to defend the subsidy program. Sean Spicer is with the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative.
We have tremendous respect for the WTO, but we don't just roll over. Especially in this particular case where we believe we're right.
He says the WTO ruling is irrelevant. World cotton prices are too high for subsidies to kick in. Bruce Babcock says the U.S. should comply with the ruling because it needs a strong WTO.
We depend a whole lot on trade, and the more free and open the trade there is, the more in aggregate that the United States wins.
But cotton subsidies may be here to stay. Congress just passed a farm bill that extends them for 5 years. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Wall Street got slapped with a wake-up call today that we still haven't seen the last of the subprime fallout. The CEO at Wachovia got shoved out, and that caused nervous investors to wonder if it signals even deeper losses at the country's fourth-largest bank. At the same time, Standard & Poor's cut its rankings for Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, and Bank of America. The credit rating agency says the outlook for the big financial institutions is now mostly negative. One guess how Wall Street reacted. Let's just say investors had a renewed case of the jitters. Details when we do the numbers. There's a tough road ahead in Lebanon in more ways than one. The country just elected a new president, and feuding political leaders are trying to work through a new power-sharing agreement. But the peace came at a price for those who rely on the wheels of commerce. Last week, scooters, mopeds, and motorcycles were banned. Officials decided the scooters were being used by young men to taunt their political opponents. As Ben Gilbert reports from Beirut, delivery workers were forced to reinvent the wheel.
In Beirut, nearly every young guy drives a moped or a motorized scooter. One of them is Jamal Jarboua, my 25-year-old translator. We made an appointment to meet at 11 a.m. Saturday morning, and he's the kind of guy who's always early, except this day. Jamal had to take a taxi and got stuck in traffic because the Lebanese army impounded his scooter last week. The same thing happened to thousands of other scooter owners and riders, causing a huge problem for Lebanon's service-based, scooter-reliant neighborhood economies. Scooter boys deliver everything in Beirut. They zip and zigzag through miles of traffic-clogged streets, bearing groceries, DVDs, dry cleaning, alcohol, and, of course, Domino's pizza.
Maximum sortiment. Maximum.
Local branch manager Mohammed Mohana repeats Domino's, "You got 30 minutes," company slogan. But 30 minutes wasn't happening. The scooter ban forced Domino's to use a car to deliver to Beirut's gridlocked neighborhoods. Last week, sales plummeted by 60%.
We
couldn't deliver to people because the order will take 1 to 2 hours, and people won't wait this time.
For local deliveries, Domino's, like many other fast food joints, replaced their scooters with bicycles. Outside the store, Domino's employee Fadi Atat was just back from a delivery.
It's hot today, huh?
Hot today, and you know.
Fadi was drenched. He appeared to be around 275 pounds. He sat atop a blue and white ladies' mountain bike that was a bit too small for him. He looked humiliated. But as of today, Fadi regained his honor and is back on his motorcycle. Due to complaints from scooter-reliant service industry owners, the Lebanese government eased the ban on Sunday. Now, businesses like Domino's can use their scooters until 12 midnight. In Beirut, I'm Ben Gilbert for Marketplace.
I've got three letters for you. YSL. The man behind one of the most legendary monograms in the history of fashion, Yves Saint Laurent, died over the weekend in Paris. He was 71. He leaves a rich, highly influential legacy and will be, as they say, a tough act to follow. We wondered how an up-and-coming designer today might hope to rise to those heights. And so we turned to Kate Betts, editor of Style and Design for Time magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What are the criteria for making it as a designer these days, and how has that changed since, say, Yves Saint Laurent was hired by Dior when he was only 21?
You know, I think today there's so much financial pressure on designers to perform commercially, and especially in America, I think that has overshadowed a lot of the creative aspects. And designers, unlike Saint Laurent, designers today are expected to be great businessmen and women, as well as great creative talents. Somebody like Saint Laurent had a business partner, Pierre Berger, who protected him from all of the kind of financial pressures and commercial considerations of the fashion business.
So what does a designer hoping to break in have to do these days?
Well, I think one thing in America that's really helped a lot of fashion designers, both clothing and accessories, is the exposure on television. When you look at a show like Sex and the City and what it did for a shoe designer like Manolo Blahnik, you know, it really put his name on the map internationally and especially in America. We've spoken a lot about Project Runway and the kind of exposure that those young kids get on that show. I think just coming at fashion from the traditional runway place and trying to make it that way is probably the most difficult thing nowadays. What happened, you know, back in Saint Laurent's heyday, it was a lot easier because fashion was much more of a local kind of almost a cottage industry. You know, the French couturiers like Saint Laurent really addressed a French clientele. American designers marketed to an American consumer. So it was very, it wasn't the global business that it is today. I think Saint Laurent was the first designer really to reach beyond the borders of his country and to address women on a kind of international scale.
You mentioned Project Runway. I have to ask, is that really a serious way to break into the business? How influential is that show?
I think it's influential in terms of the exposure it gives to the process of fashion. And I think a lot of the people who've come out of that show have been relatively successful, maybe not in terms of developing their own name, but in terms of getting started working for other designers.
Do we dare say what Yves Saint Laurent might think of that?
Well, fashion competitions have existed for a long time, and Yves Saint Laurent got his first job as an assistant to Christian Dior by winning the International Wool Secretariat Design Competition with a sketch he did of a cocktail dress. And the runner-up in that competition was Karl Lagerfeld.
So what goes around comes around.
Exactly.
Kate Betts, editor of Style and Design for Time Magazine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, industry flourishes in one Kenyan slum.
You can already see a lot of traffic, and like just a few months ago.
But first, let's do the numbers. A drumbeat of bad news from financial firms took its toll on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped just over 1%, 134 points, to close at 12,503. The Nasdaq slipped 1.25%, 31 points, to close at 2491. The S&P 500 closed 1% lower, down 14 points at 1386. Wall Street firms were awash in red today thanks to the ratings cuts we told you about earlier. Lehman Brothers bled 8%. Merrill Lynch lost nearly 3%. Morgan Stanley dropped 2.5%. Airlines flew into a rough patch after their industry watchdog issued a bleak profit warning. Delta Airlines dived almost 5%. Southwest Airlines trimmed 0.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Commerce Department reports on factory orders for April, and automakers release new car sales figures for May. The Senate Finance Committee talks about the costs and quality of health care and the need for reform. And voters are out in South Dakota and Montana for the final presidential primaries. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Can you put a price on pollution? That's the question Congress takes up this week as they begin debate on the Climate Security Act of 2008. The legislation would enact a cap-and-trade system whereby large polluters would buy and sell emission permits. Commentator and economist Andrew Samwick has taken a look at his carbon output and his family's. He says if we're serious about cleaning up our act, we should consider a straight tax on carbon.
I learned something about global warming on a family trip to Hawaii. We flew from Boston to Honolulu by way of San Francisco. I calculated the amount of jet fuel it took for the four of us to make the trip. The answer was 850 gallons. Is that a lot or a little? Well, if you drive your car 12,000 miles a year and get 20 miles per gallon, you use about 600 gallons of gasoline. So one glorious trip to Hawaii used more fuel than we used to power our cars, with corresponding amounts of carbon dioxide emitted. This comparison shows us why our efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions should focus on a carbon tax. A tax on emissions provides an incentive to reduce them everywhere, in the sky as well as on the road, at the thermostat as well as the gas pump. The more we can reduce emissions from jet fuel and home heating oil, the less we need to reduce them from automobiles. But a carbon tax is also the best way to reduce emissions from motor vehicles. Instead, Congress uses CAFE standards for new cars to discourage fossil fuel consumption. CAFE standards are like a tax on fuel-inefficient vehicles at the point of sale. They encourage people to buy more fuel-efficient cars, but here's what they don't do. They do nothing about fuel consumption by old cars. They may get you to buy a Prius, but they don't encourage you to drive it less or use it for a carpool. And they don't encourage you to maintain your vehicle or adjust your driving behavior to get better mileage. If we tax gasoline directly, we could overcome these weaknesses in the CAFE standards. The reason the tax works is that it encourages us to conserve in every way we possibly can. Nobody likes to pay higher taxes. But if we're serious about reducing emissions, a carbon tax is the most fair and comprehensive way to get the job done.
Andrew Samwick is a professor of economics at Dartmouth College and a former chief economist for the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Send us your thoughts to help clear the air. Go to marketplace.org, then click on Contact. Attention all you armchair environmentalists. Discovery Communications is launching a new cable and satellite TV channel this week. It's aiming to take the green to the mainstream. This new environmentally conscious network will be known as Planet Green. And since it's replacing the Discovery Home channel, it'll be available starting Wednesday in 50 million homes. That's almost half the nation's cable or satellite customers. For more on this, we turn to Brian Stelter, who writes about the media for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What is this channel about when they say that they're Planet Green? What does that mean exactly?
Well, Planet Green is designed to be everything about the environment, from recycling shows to news shows to reality shows starring musicians. Discovery Channel is making a big bet that environmentally themed programming can also be entertaining.
Well, the big question also is not just entertaining, but can it bring in dollars? Can it bring in an audience? How have advertisers responded?
They signed General Motors, the maker of the Hummer, as one of their premier sponsors.
Hold on. General Motors, the maker of the Hummer, is going to be advertising on a green channel.
You can imagine there are companies like that that have environmentally friendly messages they want to get across. Discovery says we want everyone to be a little better, not necessarily perfect. So they're trying to appeal to people who are interested in the environment but are not the activists that these programs have normally attracted in the past.
You mentioned General Motors as one advertiser here. What are some of the other advertisers?
General Motors is the first premier sponsor the network has announced, but they're also in talks with companies like SC Johnson, the makers of Raid and other home products, not always seen as the most environmentally friendly kind of products. But they point out they've made great strides in trying to cut down the environmental impacts of their products.
It seems to me that this would be perhaps good for an advertiser's image, whether or not they have a particular green message, just to be associated with this channel.
Certainly. Discovery says that this network is optimistic. It's supposed to be advocating for the environment, but it's also not supposed to be preachy because they've realized that the past programming about the environment, the kind of programming that Discovery innovated with 20 years ago with nature documentaries, is sometimes perceived as preachy by some viewers. And so they're trying to make it more entertaining. They're trying to make it more optimistic. And I think advertisers would want to be associated with that kind of content. I spoke to one cable executive who said, whether you're an automaker or a bank or a petroleum company, somewhere in your marketing plan is something referring to the environment. All of these companies now see that the environment is in vogue. The media is covering climate change more and more, and they have to respond to that with marketing messages.
Well, in vogue in the media, but I presume that we're going to find out whether there are enough viewers to make this worthwhile.
We sure are. This is the highest profile cable launch of the year. But there's never been programming like this before. We've never seen Ludacris and Tommy Lee on a green reality show. We've never seen Hollywood coverage of green subjects. So it's really a wait-and-see issue to see whether the ratings will improve at all.
Brian Stelter writes about the media for The New York Times. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Police fired off tear gas to break up a street demonstration in Nairobi this weekend. Hundreds gathered to protest the sharp rise in food prices. The high cost of food is just another depressing obstacle to overcome in a land where 5 million people live in slums, and more than 80% of them have no steady employment. But there's a government program aimed at turning Kenya's poorest residents into thriving business owners and building the East African nation's domestic economy. From Nairobi, Sarah Nix reports.
In the heart of Nairobi, you'll find the sprawling slum of Kibera, population 700,000. It's the largest slum in East Africa and one of the most densely packed, with more than 1,000 people per acre. Entire families live in one-room mud brick houses along garbage-strewn footpaths. Despite the poverty, Kibera is also a hive of business activity. Over the noise of hammers and saws, Michael Onganga Adiambo shows off a hand-carved piece of furniture that was built in his Kibera workshop.
This is a couch. It is a sofa. It is called a skeleton sofa, and we are selling it $120,000.
That's about $2,000 US, a steep price in a country where the average wage is about $1.50 a day. Adiambo says he's been able to sell high-end furniture only since he moved his shop to one of the few roads through the slum. Despite the mammoth potholes and heavy traffic, customers from wealthy Nairobi neighborhoods can drive in to look at the goods he has displayed on the roadside. Leah Moragori is director of the Kenya Slum Upgrading Program. She says many people living in slums are hardworking and entrepreneurial.
There is a lot of activity, especially on carpentry, soap making, bread making, bakeries.
So Moragori's program works to provide roads, electricity, and other basic infrastructure for small businesses. A new road in Kibera is already having some results.
You can already see a lot of traffic, and like just a few months ago.
About a mile from the new road, Joyce Owino sells fruits and vegetables from a small stall in front of her house. Here, the slum's footpaths are so steep and muddy that Owino has to carry all the produce in on her back. She says a little infrastructure could go a long way. If there was electricity, Owino says, she could keep the business open after dark. Streetlights would also help to keep her shop and her seven children safe. And safety is a big concern these days after riots, rape, and arson broke out across Kibera following last year's elections in Kenya. Moragori says the chaos delayed some of their projects, but has not changed one of the program's main goals: helping people create their own jobs and businesses so they don't have to rely on handouts from the government or international aid programs. In fact, furniture maker Michael Onganga Adiambo says a paved road in front of his workshop would bring in more business. Then he'd be able to employ more workers, including the most desperate Kiberans, those who've been orphaned by HIV.
Even right now, I have three orphans inside here. I'm teaching them.
Employment for one person at a time. That's how the Kenyan Slum Upgrading Program hopes to improve the livelihoods of the poorest Kenyans. If the 5 million people living in slums are able to buy, sell, and produce more, the entire economy may grow with them. In Nairobi, I'm Sarah Nix for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, if you need to run off a few copies of that business plan before the big meeting or print your kids' birthday invitations, you won't be doing it at Kinko's. Kinko's owner, FedEx, plans to drop the name on its copy and office supply stores, and it's figuring an $891 million cost to do so. The new name of the stores will be FedEx Office, a name the company says it will better describe the wide range of services available. The rebranding of its 1,900 outlets will take place over the next several years. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow heaved off 134 points, just over 1%. The Nasdaq fell 31 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 lost 14 points, 1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, building a high-tech taste test.
We build sort of an artificial taste bud, if you will, and what this allows us to do is to screen different potential flavor ingredients against these receptors.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.